Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the Sound. This is Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Thanks for tuning in to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. If you've been gripped by the tragedy and loss stemming from the Los Angeles wildfires, there's an opportunity for you to be a hero to fire and disaster victims and others right here at home by becoming a Red Cross Disaster Services volunteer. Stay tuned and we'll tell you all about it and a bunch of other news from the American Red Cross's regional office. Then we're going to reengage with the Governor M. Jody Rell Center for Public Service. We're living in interesting political times, so we'll engage a conversation that's going to help you better appreciate why your voice and presence in some type of public service may be more critical today than ever. And we're going to explore how the growing influence of artificial intelligence is impacting the lives of your kids and children living across Connecticut and the nation by tapping the authors of a brand new report from the Connecticut Voices for Children. But first, the Connecticut Department of Energy and Environmental Protection is reminding the public that incentive levels for the Connecticut Hydrogen and Electric Vehicle Purchase Rebate, or CHEEPER program, changed on January 1st. As prices for battery electric vehicles and plug-in hybrid electric vehicles continue to decline and consumer interest in the CHEEPER program continues to expand, the new incentive levels will enable DEEP to continue to meet consumer demand for the standard CHEEPER rebate within available resources while prioritizing higher incentive levels to improve EV affordability for low and moderate income residents here in Connecticut. Access all the details you need about the CHEEPER program and the new incentive levels at drivecheaper.org. That's drive, CHEAPR.org. All right. Well, as we touted earlier in the introduction, we're looking for heroes, and we hope you will be among the next crop of them serving the American Red Cross of Connecticut, which takes care of more than 3.5 million Connecticut residents in 168 towns in Hartford, Fairfield, Litchfield, Middlesex, New Haven, New London, Tolland, and Windham counties. Plus, hello, Fishers Island, New York. They're out there as well. Our guest this morning, Richard Brannigan, is the CEO of Red Cross of Connecticut and Rhode Island. So hopefully we've got some folks on the edge of the border there who are listening to us live on the air this morning, or at least tuning in on the podcast once that's released in a little while. Richard, good morning. Thanks for joining us. So much attention is being devoted westward. And yet, as I mentioned to you before we turned on the microphone, every day I am getting notices from your American Red Cross office about not one, sometimes two or even three fires somewhere in Connecticut that have displaced people and have caused damage to the extent that the Red Cross needs to respond. And, you know, as we said, bless these heroes that you've got on board so far, but they not only need to be fortified with some reserves, but they also embody a fantastic historical knowledge that they can share and mentor newcomers with.
Yeah, John, calling them heroes, calling our disaster action team members heroes is absolutely appropriate. They're as heroic as the volunteers who are delivering blood for us every day and the volunteers who are helping collect blood at blood drives by being a blood donor ambassador or to do training for CPR and first aid. About 90% of our workforce here at the American Red Cross is volunteer, and that includes especially our folks who serve in the disaster teams and who respond, as you suggested, to those fires every day and night because they're going out sometimes in the middle of the night. We are not first responders, but we are on scene typically as the fire department hoses are being rolled up. We're typically deploying some folks that will roll into the scene and help those people who unfortunately have been displaced by a fire in their place of residence. And it happens all too frequently. And at this time of year, in the winter, the numbers kick up even greater. So as soon as we turn the daylight savings clocks back and people turn on their space heaters and their ovens and a whole bunch of other things and the holidays hit, the frequency of fires really increases, and the need for us to have those volunteers out there on a daily and nightly basis is never more urgent.
Yeah, and I have to say the component of that you just mentioned, the prevention that the Red Cross plays an important role in. I mean, our fire departments, especially our smaller volunteer departments and fire marshals' offices, are typically pressed to the wall in terms of demand, just getting the day-to-day stuff down. They don't have a huge amount of time to do prevention work, and the Red Cross has stepped up in a big way, whether it's cautioning people about Christmas lights and extension cords, or the risk of Christmas tree fires, to changing the batteries and smoke and carbon monoxide detectors. You're as much the bookend to the left as you are the bookend to the right when disaster does strike.
Yeah, John, our preparedness, our home preparedness and education programs are really, really important. And, you know, we're an older organization. We were founded in 1881. The first chapter here in Connecticut, I believe, was 1897 down in the Fairfield County area. But we've been educating folks on the need for preparedness. And we do it in a very modern way, not just on our website, but we have emergency apps that folks could download and they can learn about home preparedness. They can learn about first aid. You know, it's a very convenient and modern way to do things. They can sign on to the blood donor app or the emergency app to know where shelters are available in their own community based on their GPS location. So a lot of good information out there, a lot of great resources that the public can easily take advantage free of charge, and educate and improve their own resilience in the process.
Yeah. So does Connecticut, does your office have boots on the ground in LA?
You know, we've sent some folks from Connecticut to the LA wildfires. In fact, our chief development officer is out there helping with the fundraising that's going on. And we have some folks that are deployed virtually that are doing family reunifications. We have some other folks on standby for sheltering, in taking care of the folks who had to leave their homes. They were forced to evacuate. Mm-hmm. So we've been supporting that operation for the last number of weeks. And unfortunately, it continues to flare up, literally. And we have some folks on standby. But we're a national organization, and we're deploying volunteers in. We just finished a significant round of deployments with the hurricane, quote unquote, season. Mm. We don't have seasons any longer, it seems. Right. But Helene and Milton, we were part of cadres of thousands of volunteers who went down south to the Carolinas, Tennessee, Florida, and the states in between to respond to hurricanes that were devastating. But wildfires are surely top of mind for us right now. And we're doing an amazing job out there supporting those communities that are so devastated.
Yeah. Well, if folks want to learn more, because we could probably spend the entire segment just talking about disaster services and the volunteering program, they can go to any search engine and search for Red Cross Connecticut. Once you get to the homepage for the American Red Cross of Connecticut, you can either hit the training and certification or the volunteer tabs and learn all about the specifics. Certainly, volunteers are not pressed to go outside of their own comfort zone, if you will, wherever they want to go to be able to help, or however distance they want to travel, whether it's in their own community or the region that they live in Connecticut, or to points far flung to help folks that they may have never even known before, like your team out in LA. People can go to the website for that. But you also mentioned another important thing, and that is the heroes who are stepping up with donations. And I'd like to just give you a quick opportunity to remind people who are moved by this but worried about giving money or pushing money in the wrong or inappropriate direction. Give them an idea of how their donations are going to work for those most in need when they donate to the Red Cross.
Yeah, John, thank you. The interesting part about the American Red Cross is we are chartered by Congress to respond to disaster. Our charters also include supporting the military and international relief. That disaster response charter requires us to be there. We're going to be there for the long haul in California, just like we're still working in the Carolinas and down in Florida.
In Maui, right?
And in Maui. Yeah. 2 years after the fact, we're helping to rebuild Maui and Lahaina. And we stay in it, not just because we're required to by Congress, but we are a humanitarian organization. We're part of a worldwide network, the Red Crescent Movement, that focuses on helping people in need. And there's no greater need than after a disaster. And we're seeing that play out in the LA County area right now. So we'll be there for the long haul. The thing that confuses people sometimes is I say we're chartered by Congress, so we're going to respond, but we're not funded by Congress to respond to disaster like FEMA is or some of the other federal agencies. We're funded by the generosity of the American public. And that means the folks that are listening to this broadcast, the corporate donors that we have, the individuals across the country and right here in our own Connecticut and Rhode Island listening area. They're the ones that fuel the engine. They're the ones that help us deliver the mission. And through our volunteer network, we're able to do that. And having volunteers delivering that mission, you know, as opposed to paid staff, makes all the sense in the world, because we're a voluntary led organization. And, you know, it's so much more economical to have our volunteers out there doing the lion's share of the work when you think about it. So the resources that we're expending are going to the right locations. And in the case of California, we're taking care of the immediate needs now. We're offering financial assistance to folks that had been displaced. And in some cases, there's no chance of going back to their homes. They've been completely destroyed. Mm. But we'll be there for the long haul as well. We'll be part of the community solution as we are in Lahaina and on Maui, in working with local community groups and working in long-term recovery and basically employing local residents to come work as part of the Red Cross mission to deliver those services and bring those communities back to a point of vitality going forward. So when they invest in us, they're investing in a mission that delivers hope to those communities impacted by disaster.
And I imagine that investment is most directly delivered and safely handled by donating directly through the redcross.org website. Don't trust a Facebook site that says, click below to donate to the Red Cross immediately, or to other sites that promise a pass-through. The direct donation through redcross.org is the surest and most secure way to put any dollar that you can spare to work faster on behalf of Red Cross.
Yeah, John, thanks for that point. And on average, 91 cents on our dollar received is going into the delivery of our services, again, through our volunteers and through our network. And we work in conjunction with local communities. So in California, just like in Maui and just like in the Carolinas and Florida, we're working with local communities, political leaders, emergency managers, fire departments, religious groups, you know, all of the partners at the table that to make sure that we're in the right locations and delivering services to those that need it most. And in many cases, since we're a neutral organization, we're looking out for those people also that are not represented at those tables traditionally. So Our services are just the same as they are in other countries around the world. We're a neutral humanitarian organization here in the United States.
Great. We've got a few more minutes with Richard Brannigan, CEO of Red Cross of Connecticut and Rhode Island. Certainly another life-saving and life-sustaining initiative of the Red Cross. Could be helping folks, many, many folks who are listening to our conversation this morning. Certainly their neighbors, friends, coworkers, and others, family members. And I'm talking about blood services. And while the major bulk of Red Cross outreach now has been around disaster services, we at least not forget how critical the blood services needs are, and also to the heroes who give and give and give to as blood donors.
Yeah, John, talk about heroes. The folks that come in and roll up their sleeve and are platelet donors or come in to a blood drive and they come in with a purpose in mind and they leave with that sense of satisfaction that they've really impacted in a very, very positive way, a life of someone they don't even know. But a simple act of donating blood is something not everyone does, although, you know, a number of people are qualified to do that. Not everyone steps up. And at this time of year, with snowstorms and cold and flu season and distractions with devastating wildfires in California that impact our abilities nationally to collect blood, there's no time like the present. The need for blood is constant. The need in hospitals and trauma victims and cancer patients, and we all know someone who has either received blood somewhere along the line or as a family member knows someone or been a donor of blood or blood products like platelets in the past. But there's no time like the present to do that. Again, finding a blood drive is as simple as logging onto our website, typing in your zip code, and you can find a blood drive near you, make an appointment. And the process takes for a blood donation, it usually takes about an hour of time to make that happen. And you really feel good about what you've done to help a fellow human being.
There's virtually a blood drive happening almost 7 days a week somewhere in Connecticut, likely close enough to anyone listening to be able to respond with a short drive, which will potentially save a life. And we hope folks will get involved with that. Once again, redcross.org or web search American Red Cross of Connecticut. Go to their website and you can learn all about it and learn all about the various criteria and things you need to know and things you need to bring and stuff like that. The other thing, and I know we didn't really touch on this as a prompt ahead of our conversation, Richard, but I know you can speak to it as we turn our attention out of this ice box of cold here as it starts to warm up as our program broadcasts on Sunday. It's still nowhere near swimming season unless you're a super brave and experienced. But the Red Cross, it's never too early to think about water safety. And the Red Cross also plays a critical role in helping to train countless people to learn how to swim and to be instructors for swimming lessons, right?
Oh, absolutely. The core curriculum for water safety is based on Red Cross standards that were started just over 100 years ago. And so we're the first to write the book on water safety. We continue to push that out. We share with our partners in local camps and in recreation facilities and so forth that train people to prevent drowning, but also to learn how to swim. And that's a lifetime learning. Once you know how to swim, it's not something you easily forget. To be trained as a lifeguard or to be trained as a water safety instructor following our standards brings that to another level. That was one of the trainings I took when I was in high school. I was trained to be a lifeguard through Red Cross, and it was first opportunity I had to give back to my community was through Red Cross, and I know that you have a personal experience as well with that, John.
Yes. And in terms of lifeguards, I mean, now's the time to start thinking about that training, because when the desperate call for help from parks and recreation departments or public pool facilities and beach clubs and things go out in April or May, you still have to go through the certification, and you may not actually get on the job for the amount of time where the need is heightened. So now's the time to start thinking about becoming a lifeguard and getting trained through this century-old Red Cross established training and certification program. Richard, I thank you so much for taking time to talk to us and our listeners this morning about these critically important things. The call for heroes, folks, we really need you here in Connecticut and points beyond to respond to the tragedies and disasters of your neighbors. You can do that or become a responsible donor to help the Red Cross carry out those efforts. Of course, the call for blood is a daily critical need here in Connecticut, or as we just mentioned, maybe it's just about diving into swimming lessons and becoming a certified Red Cross lifeguard. Richard, thank you so much for the time this morning. Redcross.org is the place to start, or just web search American Red Cross of Connecticut. Richard is the CEO of Red Cross of Connecticut and Rhode Island. Richard, we'll talk to you again. Thanks so much. We hear a lot about artificial intelligence, and Connecticut Voices for Children is doing something about it. They've released a new report called Beyond the Algorithm, AI Governance for Building Safe Digital Futures. This report explores the growing influence of AI on children's lives and outlines recommendations for legislative and regulatory framework to ensure AI technologies are used responsibly and equitably. We're pleased to be joined by Emily Knox and Carmen Clarkin. They are both research and policy experts with Connecticut Voices, and they played critical roles in developing this report. We'll be back to talk with them, but right now we want to quickly talk about another area of Connecticut, and that's how we fund everything through taxes. Yes, there's no getting around it. It's tax season, and the Taxpayer Education Center at Connecticut's Department of Revenue Services, our state's tax agency, was recently created through a taxpayer lens to assist Connecticut taxpayers in finding the specific information they need to easily file and pay their Connecticut taxes. The center is going to be updated frequently with the most current tax topics and will include tutorial videos to help guide you on how to file in the quickest, easiest, and most accurate ways. The office is currently hosting a series of webinars to better help taxpayers understand things like the state income tax, pensions and annuities, and the earned income tax credit. Access them and loads of other consumer information by visiting ct.gov/drs/videos. I'm sure the earned income tax credit is a subject that is no stranger to my guests this morning. Emily and Carmen, welcome to the program. Thank you for your important work with Connecticut Voices.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having us. Yeah, we're so happy to be here.
So who's going to set us up? Emily, let's get a minute or so of background on your involvement with helping to produce this report.
This report has been in the works for quite some time, and my kind of focus in it was really the policy analysis and policy recommendations.
Oh, and then I was just going to say, yeah, so we split up the writing of this report, and I focused primarily on kind of setting up the context, doing a review of the landscape and the ways that artificial intelligence impacts children. And like Emily said, she then followed up with the policy landscape, and we crafted the policy recommendations based off of both of those things.
So, Carmen, what was one of the most either interesting or concerning things that you learned through your research?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. One of the things that really stood out to us was the fact that deceptive design techniques that are often used to gain access to data that can then be processed by artificial intelligence it's more often and more frequently used on platforms that are made for and target children. So that was particularly concerning to us. Something else along those lines is that social media utilizes these deceptive design tactics more so than other platforms as well. And as we all know, children are on social media a lot these days. And they're online a lot, more than ever before. So that was a big part of why this was a really big concern for us.
How about for you, Emily?
I think I echo Carmen's concerns with deceptive design and just the volume of information that kids are, one, exposed to online, but also creating for themselves. We talk in this report about digital footprints and the volume of data that kids have following them in perpetuity for the rest of their lives, and the degree to which AI can leverage these digital footprints in ways that make decisions in really critical sectors like healthcare, like finances, and the degree to which we just don't know what the long-term impact of this looks like. There's tremendous amount of data following each kid that can be used to develop really detailed profiles of individuals. And we just don't know what the future looks like and how AI is going to continue to leverage all of this data that kids are creating from increasingly early ages. Frequently even without their consent or understanding how and where their data is being collected. So I think that's what's startling and creates some of the motivation around this for me.
Something that is that we kind of help people conceptualize this, how we talk about it is it's almost like you have this real life permanent record. You know, there's the proverbial permanent record when kids are in school and you're younger, but this is an actual permanent record that will follow you for the rest of your life, like Emily was saying. So I think that's a really great way to contextualize it for people, and that's how we kind of try to explain it a little bit.
Yeah, I guess the old cliche is once it's on the internet, no matter how many times you click erase, cancel, you try to get rid of it, it is all always still indelibly stamped somewhere in those ones and O's for someone to find and potentially exploit. So that's why this report was so critically important. And what we want to do is not only help people access and read this report, but then also spur them to action through some of these policy recommendations. The session of our Connecticut General Assembly is happening right now, so perhaps now is the perfect time for people to reach out to our Connecticut lawmakers to ask them to act on one or more of these policy recommendations that came out of this report. Can people go to Connecticut Voices for Children's website to access it?
Yes, all of our policy recommendations are included in the report body. So every granular point we want to make and all of our policy recommendations are just included within the text of the report itself, which is available on Voices website.
Very good. So then let's get to the policy recommendations. Emily, give us a couple of the ones that most resonated with you.
Sure. So our report includes a pretty comprehensive set of recommendations, really aimed at ensuring responsible and equitable AI governance, and also a flexibility that can change with this really rapidly evolving technology. So I think what stands out for me, we recommend putting in place measures to protect individuals against deepfakes and non-consensual AI content. That's one of the policy spaces where we've seen a lot of uptake at the state level, I think because deepfakes are such an understandable threat of AI. So we do make policy recommendations related to that kind of non-consensual AI content. And we also recommend clear disclosure requirements so that we can make sure individuals know when they're interacting with an AI system. And really importantly, to add on to that, is plain language guidelines for those disclosures. So that not only do people know they're interacting with AI, but that they're being notified in a way that's accessible, that makes sense to them. And that we also move forward in creating more accessible opt-out mechanisms that allow users to control how and when their data is collected. Okay. So I think those are my primary
Yeah. How about you, Carmen? Were there some different ones that you brought to the table that ended up formulating into policy recommendations?
So something that we thought was really important and came out of some work that I had done previously was the policy recommendation of adopting a risk-based regulatory approach. And so what that basically means is that as the risk increases for a type of artificial intelligence application, so does the regulation. And this is what they use, this framework is what they use in the EU AI Act. And it allows us to focus on stricter oversight for high impact applications while maintaining flexibility for lower risk uses of AI. So a low risk use, for example, might be, you know, spell check or some kind of grammar checker, whereas higher risk AI has to do, it's categorized as something that might lead to like cognitive manipulation of a person, which we can all agree that's bad. We don't want that. So as, like I said before, as the risk increases, so does the regulation.
So as the world of AI development continues to be a little bit more Wild West than a controlled experiment, one of the other points that elevated to me was supporting ethical innovation. We need to inspire those who are developing AI to do it in an ethical way. Can that motivation, do you think, can it be helped or better directed through recommendations of governmental policies and actions?
Most certainly. Emily, do you want to talk a little bit about some of our policy recommendations in that regard?
Well, I think addressing the level of our policy recommendations, we're approaching AI as a structural issue. And so we've made kind of structural level legislative regulation level policy recommendations because it is a structural problem that requires structural solutions. Mm-hmm. So while we, you know, kind of toyed with the idea of looking at individual ways to, you know, promote data privacy or protect ourselves, I think it was really imperative for us because one, we're voices, and also understanding the scope and impact of this problem to really craft solutions at the same level as the problem. Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things that we came across in the research was that there are other states who are doing things like creating regulatory sandboxes for testing of artificial intelligence in sort of this controlled environment. And something else that other states are doing that we sort of looked to for a blueprint was, you know, offering grants to responsible developers to help promote innovation without stifling kind of smaller developers or startups who want to be using AI, because artificial intelligence is the way of the future. So we need to figure out a way to continue moving forward in the most responsible manner possible. And those are some of the examples that we've seen from other states that we think could really work here in Connecticut.
So, Carmen, if there was, in the last couple minutes that we have, if there was one thing you could reach out and tell any of our listeners to perhaps think about articulating to their Connecticut state representatives now that they're in session. From your perspective, Carmen, what single point do you think would make the biggest difference?
So I would say that one of the main things we wanted people to take away from this paper is that artificial intelligence regulation, it is a children's issue. There are implications for our children's futures that are under-discussed but extremely important, and regulations should center children's rights, privacy, safety, and well-being in this conversation because they're the ones who will be growing up in the world that we create today. You know, I do think, you know, yes, parents, they play a role in safeguarding their children online, but they can't do it alone, and I think really underscoring that to legislators, especially when it comes to navigating this complicated landscape. As Emily mentioned earlier, this is a structural issue. And so it really requires structural solutions. And we know that government regulation plays a crucial role in safeguarding children by limiting their exposure to inappropriate or dangerous content and activities, right? We don't let six-year-olds gamble, and we don't put cigarettes in the candy aisle, and that's because of government regulation. So I think if people can really put into context that this is an issue bigger than them, and that they need government help. We need government regulation in this area. Mm. I think that is a big takeaway that we want people to come away with right. from reading this paper.
And Emily, you get the last word. Your thoughts or suggestions to people who might want to first read this report and then articulate a substantial concern to their lawmakers here in Connecticut?
Sure. I think what I'd like folks most to take away really is the sense of urgency around this issue. We've seen the consequences of trying to regulate technologies retroactively. Social media is a great and really obvious example of that, where the harmful effects on like mental health and privacy and even democracy became apparent really only after really widespread adoption. And with AI, we're at this critical place in time where we have an opportunity and responsibility to really be proactive in this space, setting safeguards to prevent tremendous adverse impacts before they become more deeply ingrained. So I think for me, the most fundamental piece of this report is really generating the sense of urgency. AI is developing incredibly quickly and growing, you know, day over day, and we need to be, you know, have a similar sense of urgency in approaching our regulation.
You've been listening to the main contributors of the new report from Connecticut Voices for Children, Beyond the Algorithm, AI Governance for Building Safe Digital Futures. You can read it at the website for Connecticut Voices for Children, simply ctvoices.org. Emily Knox, Carmen Clarkin, thank you. We also want to thank Ashley and the Narrative Project for helping us put this interview together. A fantastic team developing and releasing fantastic results in this report. We hope you'll go to Connecticut Voices for Children's website, read it, and then act by speaking out to your state and federal legislators about the issues involving AI. Thank you guys for your conversation this morning. It's been a while since we talked to the good folks at the Governor M. Jody Rell Center for Public Service. Sadly, since the last time we spoke with Dr. Catherine Owens at the center, we lost Governor Rell. We'll be talking a little bit about that and a number of other things. The Rell Center seeks to encourage students and others to pursue careers in public service and to assist in providing a clearinghouse for student public service internships. They also want to get you involved in your hometown, your neighborhood, your community, school, what have you. We'll be talking all about that. But first, we want to turn our attention to the fun, recreation, and entertainment of sporting events and concerts. You know, securing tickets to popular sporting events and concerts can be difficult and competitive. Many stadiums and venues have gone to only accepting digital tickets, making the possibility for scams all the more likely. Thanks to the internet, there are countless ways for consumers to find tickets and connect with online marketplaces, ticket sellers, and resellers. Unfortunately, some are ripoffs, and it's unclear how to tell if a ticket is fake. Last year, the Better Business Bureau received over 140 reports on BBB Scam Tracker about ticket scams related to sporting events, concert, theater, and more right here in Connecticut. You can protect yourself and enjoy a scam-free ticket experience by adopting the NATB's 10 Commandments of ticket buying, and you can access them by visiting natb.org. All right, off to the University of Hartford and the Governor M. Jody Rell Center for Public Service. Dr. Owens, welcome to the program, and please, you knew Governor Rell, I knew Governor Rell. My condolences to you, because I'm sure you spent a lot more time with her than I did.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Yeah, I think in some ways, you know, as it often happens when you lose someone, it kind of hits you in stages. And you don't, you know, you think about it more, I should say, when you go and do the things that you would, where you would expect to see them and where you would expect to spend time with them. So that's certainly on my mind as we start a new semester at the University of Hartford and begin the next, you know, semester's worth of work for the Governor M. Jody Rowell Center.
Reflecting on perhaps the most potent or important time that you spent with Governor Rowell one-on-one, could you share a reflection or two about what endeared her most to you?
She was always a pleasure to work with. I really appreciated her kind of no-nonsense approach to things. I got to, of course, work with her a lot through the Rowell Center. I got to interview her for our podcast and just get her thoughts on things. And, you know, I think one of the things I appreciate most that she said to me, we were talking about the state of politics in the world, and she kind of said, you know, why can't people just be nice? And I think it's easy to think that that's a simple or naive take on things, but I think she, more than most of us, understood how difficult and challenging it is to be nice to people, especially people you don't agree with. And she truly reflected that at every level in any and every interaction that I had with her. So yeah, I think she's going to be really, really missed here.
Yeah, yeah. My personal experience, and I may have reflected on this before with you prior to her passing, but when I was working in print journalism over in Western Connecticut, I had the opportunity to tag along with her on a tour at an innovative local manufacturing company. And as we were leaving, she was walking out to the car and we were just chit-chatting. And I said, well, I got to get going. It's my son's birthday today. And she was like, oh, well, you know, and we did a little bit of small talk about him. And she said, well, turn on your tape recorder. I'll send him a birthday message. And I put on the tape recorder and she sent this wonderful message, speaking right to him, calling him by name. And it was just, 30 seconds you never forget.
Yeah. So kind.
That really sums up the kind of person that she was. It was always people before politics with Jody Rowell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you are heading up a spectacular tribute to her legacy there at the Rowell Center. And although the lead up to her passing in 2024 was sad, it was a very, very busy, exciting, and productive year for the center, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think we're really fortunate to have... we have a great team here, myself and a couple of interns. We have a wonderful board of governors who support our work and who we run ideas by and get input from. And we've had some great programming. We had a nice initiative around sort of promoting civility and encouraging people, reminding people about how to practice civility. And we printed up some really great posters and some pamphlets with that. We have an annual award for teachers or administrators who are doing wonderful things in their own communities, at their schools or institutions, to promote kindness and civility. And that's an ongoing competition that we have. People can go to our website at hartford.edu/rel to nominate a teacher or an administrator who's doing great things at the local level, because I think that's what's such a wonderful sort of like legacy of Governor Rowell's, and an important thing to emphasize in our own community, to look for the positive stories and focus on the good that people are doing rather than the bad that people are doing.
And I see here as I'm perusing the latest newsletter, this Keep It Civil initiative. That's something that I know that the RELS Center and you would like to see a little bit more high profile now as local governments are convening and looking at what 2025 is going to look like. Is that something that folks can still access to maybe hang in their municipal centers or their libraries or other community gathering places?
Absolutely. We have it all available online through our website on the University of Hartford's website. But I also have physical copies. We went ahead and printed up a good number of those, and we would love to share them. People can reach out to me at my email address, kowens@hartford.edu. And we definitely have these to share. There's no time constraints on being civil, right? So we'll keep passing out these brochures and these posters as long as we can, because I think that message is only going to become more important as time passes. So yes, we would love to share the materials we produce with more people and with more communities.
You mentioned the 2024 Civility Awards, and you certainly had a number of spectacular representatives of that title this year in 2024.
Yes, we did. We were really fortunate to, and it's such a pleasure to read the stories of people who are nominating themselves or other people are nominating them. We welcome both of those. We had two different teachers from Silas Dean Middle School in Weathersfield, Carrie Anzadai and Kylene Casasanta, who were doing really cool things around clubs for kids at their school, one with a student council club and the other with a kindness club. And then we also recognize Dr. Scott Nickel, who's the superintendent of Ellington Public Schools, because he's one of the leaders of their Seeds of Civility project, which has a lot of things in common with our own Keep It Civil campaign, where they're really trying to, throughout their community, infuse public meetings and interactions with sort of tenets of civility that they hope everyone can take part in and agree to. We were thrilled to get the opportunity to recognize these teachers and this administrator who were doing such amazing work in their communities.
It was also obviously a busy year for politics, and the RELS Center and you and your representatives were there hosting debate watch parties for the president and vice president, right?
Yes, we did. And we it's very important on a college campus. Elections, of course, are very important. But when we hosted these events, we paid for cupcakes and cookies, which is almost as important to college kids. To get free snacks is a big highlight for them. So we opened it up on the residential side of campus. Some of our partners on campus brought in big TVs and speakers so the students could hear what was going on. And we had tables where some of our interns were passing out T-shirts and giving students information about where to vote and how to vote. Oftentimes for a college kid, it might be their first election or maybe their second, usually their first. And they have a lot of questions. Do I register at home? Do I register at school? What's my plan for going to vote on the day? Can I go home to vote? So we wanted to offer a nonpartisan resource to them just to help them think through those questions ahead of time. So that was a really great opportunity to get students involved, to lead their other students in sort of information and to try to encourage our students to be thinking about politics and becoming more engaged in civics and civics process.
Yeah. And right there in the smack dab in the middle of 2024. You came to my hometown, Waterbury, to our beautiful Palace Theater, and hosted one of our media colleagues, Jeremy Hobson from Connecticut Public, over there at the Palace Theater for a live taping of his program, The Middle. But what was interesting was the subject matter of it. You don't necessarily think of climate change when you think of the Rell Center.
No, I mean, so there, the whole idea of The Middle is that they want to connect with, you know, help people in the middle, geographically, politically, or philosophically, people who want to come together in the middle to find solutions to the problems that are facing our country. And my background is in environmental policy, so I was thrilled that there was also a climate change component, but we were really there because it's such a great venue for civil discourse around a contentious, or what can be a contentious issue. So it was a great opportunity for the Rell Center to support that work. And it's always a lot of fun to be at a live taping of a public radio program or any kind of radio program. So I went with my family. I brought my family, and we had a great time watching the show.
Yeah, and a beautiful venue as well. So let's now pivot to 2025 and beyond. We're in substantially more interesting times now than we maybe were even at this time last week. And that may not change. Now maybe is the time that it's most important for people in our communities here in Connecticut to step up and volunteer at the level of government where they can make the most difference to their neighbors and communities. And that's stepping up to either get appointed or elected to some type of service here in Connecticut.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think we tend to focus on national politics, but I tell my students, you know, your voice is going to have a much bigger impact at the state and local levels. And we know since the pandemic, you know, a lot of those sort of board positions or commission positions or volunteer positions are people are shying away from them a little bit because they did become, some of them, volatile during the pandemic and the time after that. So I think it's always a really it's important to remind people that they can get involved in local politics and local positions like that, and can contribute to their communities and really make a difference in important ways.
What kind of resources or information can folks get by coming to the Rell Center for public service if they're entertaining the idea of maybe checking in with their local mayor's office or first selectman's office and finding out how they might be able to plug their passion or expertise into making their community in Connecticut a better place to live?
That's a great idea. We don't sort of at this point work to connect the community at large with sort of positions in local government or even opportunities for volunteering. We haven't played that role in the past, but it's a great idea. We do try to put in front of our students representatives of different kinds of institutions or organizations, state government commissions, that kind of thing, to put that on their radar a little bit. And as my home department is the Department of Politics, Economics, and International Studies, we certainly want our students to be aware of all of the work that happens at the state and local level, all the job opportunities that exist there. I think sometimes it's not on their radar the way other things can be. But they're great jobs and a great opportunity for students to get involved in the working, you know, of their community, their town or city. So the Rell Center doesn't necessarily have a resource where we connect the public with those positions, but we certainly do encourage our students to think about those kinds of roles. Mm. And we've had great success with students who are interested in getting involved in the school board or going to work at the Department of Environmental and Energy protection. So we do make those connections with some of our students, which is great to see.
Yeah. And people can always find out what's going on at the Rel Center through your podcast, which we're plugging on our podcast.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Yes, that's usually led by the student interns each semester. So it definitely follows the academic calendar, and we try to put out a few stories every semester where we do things like interview the award winners from our civility awards. We can hear more about their projects and learn more about their work. And we've interviewed, of course, Governor Rell in our first season, and then other civic leaders over time. So, yeah, it's a great resource with stories about people who are getting involved in public service or volunteering in their community. Mm.
Well, we hope people get to know the Rell Center for Public Service at the University of Hartford. Don't forget, they have created brochures and posters to help remind folks in your community about the tenets of civility. If you'd like brochures or posters, our guest this morning, Dr. Catherine Owens, has invited you to reach out to her directly through her email, kowens@hartford.edu, to order up physical copies that you can place with permission in public spaces. We hope that you'll take advantage of that, or perhaps you'd like to make a donation to support the Rell Center and the great work that they're doing and great work yet to do. You can do all that by just going to hartford.edu and go down to that left menu and find the Rell Center for Public Service, and you can dig into a lot of the background information that you'll need to understand better how they are working to make Connecticut a more civil and better place to live through service. Dr. Catherine Owens, we appreciate your time this morning. Thank you for joining us here on the program. We can't wait to see what else 2025 has in store for the Rell Center, and we'll talk to you again.
You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a PSA for our program that's relevant to the audiences and communities we serve, you must make your request for consideration in writing via email to john.vocat@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program can be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station websites. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Vocat. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime. Just find it under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shape the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisisCLE.com/podcast.